Chapter 28. Gentlemen Crooks. Although it's been somewhat obscured by inverted snobbery, the urge to become a gentleman remains one of the most powerful motivations in most civilised societies. Half a century ago, it was open and unconcealed. Anyone who enjoys records of old music hall songs knows how many of them were about a man pretending to be a toff. Like Burlington Bertie, who demonstrates his gentility by walking down the Strand with his gloves on, and then walking down again with them off. And the literature of the period is also frankly dominated by class feeling. Oscar Wilde belonged to the upper classes by right, his father being a knight, yet he was still fascinated by the aristocracy. So, in a different way, was that sturdily working-class writer D.H. Lawrence, who, after his marriage to a German aristocrat, took care to mention casually in all his letters that her father was a von. It's easy enough to understand the 19th century reason for this fascination. Thousands of poor people literally froze and starved to death every winter, and so the thought of security and wealth, of winters on the Riviera, of large country houses, was like a dream of heaven. In our present-day welfare society, no one starves to death, and it might therefore be expected that the interest in the aristocracy would gradually fade away. It's done nothing of the sort. When a human being has satisfied his or her desire for a home, for sexual security and a family, the next level of need to emerge is the craving for self-respect, the desire to be looked up to by other people. This need is as universal as the sexual urge. Consequently, everybody feels a certain admiration, or envy, for those who are above him in the self-esteem hierarchy. It's as fundamental as the interest we feel in Don Juan or Casanova, or in the famous Scarlet Women of history. So it makes no real difference that we're living in an altogether more affluent society than that of our great-grandfathers. It still remains a fundamental human daydream to be born in a position that automatically confers respect. One of the early Blondie cartoons showed a uniformed hall porter addressing Dagwood as Sir, and Dagwood is so drunk with delight and self-importance that he walks round and round in the revolving door. We laugh at this, but James Thurber's Walter Mitty, who has fantasies about being a great surgeon, a fighter pilot, a ship's captain, is a universal symbol. This explains why the gentleman crook is such a familiar figure in the police courts. It's not so much because crooks find the role of gentleman an effective disguise, as that the craving to be a gentleman drives them into crime. Some gentleman crooks actually achieve their ambition and are accepted as gentlemen in high society. This is what happened to Casanova, who was born the son of a poor actor. His charm, his ready wit, and his skill as a confidence man carried him into the society of kings and lords, who accepted him as a man of culture and intelligence. The same was true of another remarkable impostor of the late 18th century, the Count Saint-Germain, who set out to be a man of mystery. He liked people to believe that he was many hundreds of years old, making casual reference to historical events, like the crucifixion, as if he had been present. Saint-Germain also claimed that he never ate, and he would sit at the dinner tables of the rich with only a glass of water in front of him. He was widely believed to have magical powers. However, he did not take in all of his contemporaries, and one of them, Count Vanstedt, described him as the completest fool, charlatan, rattle-pate, windbag and swindler. Saint-Germain undoubtedly was something of an inventive genius, particularly in the field of textiles, so he can't be dismissed as a gentleman crook. The same is true of another of his remarkable contemporaries, Cagliostro, the founder of a secret order of Freemasons. Although there can be no doubt that he was a windbag and a pretender, he also possessed a certain amount of genuine occult knowledge, as well as being a brilliant doctor. These men, then, are genial impostors rather than gentlemen crooks, but they make fascinating studies for the criminologist because the basic motivation is the same. The real thing is always of a lower order. Most gentlemen crooks lack the polish and intelligence of a Casanova or a Saint-Germain. As a typical example, we may consider the case of Vidocq and the gentleman crooks, recounted by the famous criminal-turned-detective in his memoirs. The story begins one night in 1817, when a butcher named Fontaine set out from his home in Courtille, near Paris, to buy cattle at the Corbeil market. Fontaine was a stupid man who was given to boasting, and, like many such individuals, he was highly susceptible to flattery from his betters. In a bistro near Essonne, he began to talk to two well-dressed and rather well-spoken travellers. They seemed to be gentlemen, and Fontaine tried to impress them by talking about the amount of money he made in his business. Time went past, and he suddenly realized that it was late afternoon. His new acquaintances pressed him to stay overnight, but Fontaine was a stubborn man. He wanted to sleep at Corbeil, to be up early for the market. One of the gentlemen now suggested to the other that perhaps they ought to go with him, since it was their direction too, and besides, three of them would be a deterrent to highwaymen. They seemed so polite and well-mannered that Fontaine had no suspicions. They set off walking, stopped for another glass of wine a few miles along the road, and then continued to walk on after dark. One of the men had a limp. When they came to a narrow lane, the man with the limp said it was a shortcut to Corbeil. Fontaine followed him without suspicion. Suddenly he felt a tremendous blow on the back of his head, and he fell to his knees. The other gentleman pulled a knife and began stabbing him. Fontaine fought back with his stick, but after receiving 28 stab wounds, he fainted from loss of blood. When he woke up, his money was gone. His groans attracted a passer-by, and he was taken to hospital. Recovery was slow, but Fontaine was tough, and besides, he was determined to have his own back on his treacherous gentleman acquaintances. Vidocq, the detective, talked to him in hospital, and then proceeded immediately to the scene of the crime. There were footprints in the mud, and Vidocq had casts made of these. He also found two buttons in the mud and some fragments of a letter. Fontaine had torn off part of a pocket from one of his assailants. The letter fragments must have fallen out. The words read, "Monsieur Rao, wine bar ba... Roche Cli..." The paper was similar to that used for court summonses. Vidocq decided that the full address should read, "Monsieur Rao, Barrière Rochechouart, Clignancourt," a suburb of Paris. Raoul had an underworld reputation as a smuggler, ran a sleazy bar, and was, compared to most crooks, something of a gentleman. Vidocq had the bar watched. His agent finally saw a fairly well-dressed man with a limp and followed him home. Vidocq was informed and kept watch on the house. When the limping man came out, Vidocq recognised him as a crook named Cour. Vidocq had arrested him years previously for robbery with violence. Now Vidocq was sure he was on the right trail. He got a warrant, gained entry to Cour's room by claiming to be Raoul, and arrested him. But Cour's room contained no evidence to connect him with the attack on Fontaine. Vidocq spent the next day in Raoul's bar. Raoul was not there, and the man behind the counter would only give him information that Raoul was in his room in Montmartre. Hours later, the bar owner returned. Vidocq now tried bluff. He introduced himself and told Raoul that he was suspected of holding revolutionary meetings on his premises and of possessing inflammatory literature. Raoul indignantly denied having democratic tendencies and told Vidocq he could search the house. Vidocq's men did just that, but found nothing. "How about your place in Montmartre?" said Vidocq. "Oh, you can search that too," Raoul said sullenly. Vidocq called two cabs, and he and his men drove to Montmartre, where Raoul led them to a house. Vidocq was fairly certain that he would find nothing obviously incriminating. Raoul looked too unworried. All the same, he did find what he was looking for, the police court summons with a corner missing, the corner which had contained Raoul's name and address, and which had been at the scene of the crime. Raoul's nerve broke, and he tried to snatch a pistol. Vidocq's men grabbed him and took him to prison. There, Vidocq had Cour and Raoul brought face to face and proceeded to play them off against one another. When he saw that Cour was obviously shaken, he played his MasterCard, the fact that the butcher, Fontaine, was still alive in spite of his 28 knife wounds and fractured skull. Cour was taken to a cell on his own and eventually signed a confession. Then Vidocq went back to Raoul, but Raoul was altogether tougher and denied everything. He had a good business in Clignancourt, he said. Why should he play the gentleman crook and waylay travellers? Vidocq went back to Cour and said, "All right, he's confessed. Will you like to talk to him?" Cour nodded, and Vidocq had them brought together. Cour immediately said, "Good, I'm glad you've confessed too. We might as well get it over with." Raoul swore, but signed a statement. The cunning Vidocq had not finished. He pretended that, now the case was cleared up, there were no hard feelings, and he treated the two men to a good supper with several bottles of wine. They ended by involving another regular accomplice, and Vidocq was able to arrest him the next day. Raoul and Cour may be taken as thoroughly representative of the class of gentleman crook. Most of them are very perceptibly not gentlemen. There's a touch of coarseness that would instantly give them away to any real gentleman. Of course, there have been exceptions. For example, Count Victor Lustig, the con man who actually sold the Eiffel Tower and whose impeccable manners reminded many of his victims of the film star Adolphe Menjou. Gerald Chapman, the Count of Gramercy Park, the man who, on the proceeds of a bank robbery, set up as an English gentleman of leisure in New York and fooled a large part of New York society. However, such men are exceptions. Criminals like Raoul and Coeur are the rule. In the year 1899, a journalist named Edward William Hornung published The Amateur Cracksman, whose hero was Raffles, the gentleman burglar. The book was an immediate and enormous success and was followed by four further Raffles books. Ironically, Hornung was the brother-in-law of Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, and for many years the popularity of Raffles equaled that of the great detective. It's interesting to consider why Raffles made such an appeal to respectable Edwardian England. He's been to a public school and university and plays cricket for a gentleman's amateur 11. Unfortunately, he lacks the money to maintain himself in the society to which he's accustomed. His old school fag, Bunny, is in the same state. So the two of them make a living by committing burglary. Naturally, most of their victims are the kind of people that excite no particular sympathy or pity in the average man. Jewellers, wealthy bankers, and the like. What Hornung implies is that Raffles is simply a bold and daring man who's chosen a life of adventure on the edge of society. Besides, he finally expiates his life of crime by dying bravely for his country. It's an interesting piece of doublethink and indicative of the curious immaturity of the average upper-class Englishman at the turn of the century. Raffles' life of crime is merely an extension of schoolboy pranks, or so we're supposed to feel. But in fact, Raffles is like no gentleman crook who ever existed, for Hornung, with his inadequate knowledge of criminal psychology, missed out the essential element, the Walter Mitty-ish daydreams, the tendency to fantasize, and the capacity for self-deception. The gentleman crook is usually out to deceive himself as well as other people. Consider the astonishing career of the Italian-born Carlo Ponzi, one of the great financial swindlers of the 20th century. Ponzi came to America from Italy as a boy immigrant, certain that he would make his fortune in the land of opportunity. In fact, his only asset was a mercurial vitality and a preposterous optimism. He began his career as a waiter, but the little man with twinkling eyes was so inclined to chatter to his customers that he quickly lost his job. He went to Montreal, worked at a series of menial jobs, and made enough money to buy himself elegant clothes and a Malacca cane, which became something of a trademark. He longed to be taken for a gentleman. He began his career of crime by swindling Italian immigrants of money, which he promised to send to their relations in Italy, and he soon went to prison. He came to Boston just after the First World War, married a pretty girl called Rose, and became the manager of her father's wholesale grocery business. His business acumen was not equal to his optimism, and the father-in-law was soon ruined. Ponzi then became a clerk at $16 a week. One day, he saw a postal reply coupon in one of the firm's letters. He discovered, to his astonishment, that this coupon could be bought for 1 cent abroad and exchanged in America for 5 cents worth of stamps. It was the post office's way of encouraging business. Instantly, Ponzi saw marvellous possibilities. Borrow $5,000, spend it on coupons, exchange the coupons for $25,000 worth of stamps, and sell the stamps at a cut rate. He bought a few dollars worth of coupons and tried to exchange them, but the post office told them it was illegal to do it in such quantities. They weren't trying to give away money. Ponzi, however, saw that he was at last within reach of the fortune and position that he had always dreamed of. He went to various friends and persuaded them to invest in his scheme. He had a method of getting around the postal regulations, and he hinted that the Rockefeller fortune was based on the same trick. They lent him money. 3 months later, he paid them back 50%, which, he said, was pure interest. Reinvest it, he said, you can't lose. They took his advice, and so did their friends. Ponzi soon had enough money to float the financial exchange company, and he was taking $3,000 a day. One enthusiastic admirer shouted, "You're the greatest Italian in history!" Ponzi said modestly, "No, no, Columbus was greater." There was method in his madness. He was, of course, repaying the interest out of the money he took in, but he reasoned that if he could make enough money, he would be able to invest in legitimate business, exercise his business genius, which neither he nor anyone else doubted for a moment, and soon become a millionaire. He actually bought shares in the Hanover Trust Company and purchased the J.P. Poole Company. He bought his wife Rose a vast mansion. He might have succeeded, but for one mistake. He called in a real financial expert to act as his public relations man. When William McMasters realised that his financial empire was built on sand and that Ponzi's genius was largely optimism and sheer ignorance, he whispered a word in the ear of the state authorities. The bubble burst. Ponzi had taken $20 million, paid back three quarters of it, and spent the other $5 million. He went to prison for 10 years for fraud and grand larceny. When he came out, he decided that he would return to Italy and offer his genius to Mussolini, who seemed to be a man after his own heart. Mussolini thought so too, at first, until it dawned on him that Ponzi's chief asset was his colossal ego and his boundless and unfounded optimism. And so he was dismissed and died poverty-stricken in Rio de Janeiro in 1949. Carlo Ponzi is the Italian-American version of the gentleman crook. The English version tends to wear old-school ties, speak with a drawling accent, and call people old boy. The sex killer Neville Heath is a typical representative. So was the crook known as Anthony St. George, who arrived in the riverside village of Send near Woking in 1924. He lived in an enormous punt that had been converted into a houseboat. He was tall, athletic, and good-looking, and he seemed to have plenty of money. He was soon extremely popular in the village inn, for he was obviously a man of independent means, and it was rumoured that he was the son of a peer. He ate and drank well, and had no difficulty acquiring half a dozen mistresses. The police were worried about a series of spectacular burglaries in the area, which then, as now, was popular with retired businessmen. One day, before dawn, Police Constable Elkins was called by a householder named Lucas, who had interrupted a burglar. The burglar had only taken a pair of shoes. There was one clue, a fragment of yellow paper that looked as if it had come from a matchbook. Elkins put it in his pocket. On his way home in the dawn, he met Anthony St. George on a bicycle and asked him where he had been. St. George said that he had spent the night with a local girl, but declined to reveal her identity. Elkins didn't like his story and went to the houseboat later in the day. While talking to St. George, he took out a cigarette and asked casually, "Got a match?" St. George handed him a yellow matchbox. A small piece of the flap was missing. Elkins took this out of his pocket and tried it. "Seems a good fit," he said. St. George said plaintively, "That's not very sporting." But he went quietly. Ex-Chief Superintendent Fred Cherrill, describing St. George in his memoirs, remarks that he was a crook who had an obsession with the aristocracy. His real name was Arthur Hazel, and he had been born in Liverpool in 1894. He had never been to public school or to university. Until 1914, he was in and out of jail for petty theft. Then he went into the Coldstream Guards, became a sergeant major, and became obsessed with the idea of being a gentleman. He felt he ought to have been an officer, and this was the identity he adopted. Until 1940, St. George was in and out of prison for burglary, always of big mansions and titled families, as though this was his way of identifying with them. Stealing gold cufflinks or jewelled pendants gave him the same pleasure that some sex maniacs get from stealing women's underwear. Yet he always made the same absurd mistake. He never wore gloves, and again his fingerprints sent him to jail. Could it be that he wanted to leave his signature in the homes of the aristocracy? It's possible to conceive a democratic society without gentlemen crooks, but perhaps one has to admit that in many ways such a society would be duller.